Hey everyone, Tom Salemi here. Welcome back to the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. I've got a great interview for you today. I spoke with Daniel Hawkins, the CEO of Vista AI. It's a company that's using AI tools to make it easier to take MRI images of the heart. And this seems like a departure for Daniel, who's a med tech guy, although his previous company, Avail Med Systems, was not your typical medical device company. It was a visionary company that was trying to strengthen the telepresence in the OR. So in that way, it does seem like a connected move. But Daniel's background is quite extensive. He's got a great blue blood pedigree. We'll talk about his time at Intuitive. We'll talk about his work with Shockwave and more, and what it takes to be an inventor. So I really enjoyed reconnecting with Daniel Hawkins and having him share Vista AI's story. No Newmarkers today. Chris Newmarker and I could not connect. It was one of those crazy Fridays. I don't know. It just wasn't working out. So fortunately, my conversation with Daniel was extensive, and I think you'll get a full serving of Device Talks Weekly. Before we begin the podcast, though, please come and join us at Device Talks of Boston on April 30th and May 1st. You can go to boston.devicetalks.com to register. I'll begin announcing keynote speakers and the like over the coming week. We're rolling out the agenda, and it's going to be a great program. You have until probably 3 weeks or so before our early bird rate expires, so don't miss out on that. Thanks to everyone who joined us for our Device Talks Tuesdays Look Ahead series. We had nearly 1,000. By the time you're listening to this, probably 1,000 people registered for that. Hundreds were in attendance, and we had a lot of great conversations around surgical robotics, ASCs, and the fundraising environment. So we'll do more of those virtual kind of editorial conversations in the future. But we've got a lot of other great programs coming your way, brought to you by our great sponsor network. So go to devicetalks.com to check out our upcoming sessions. Other than that, Device Talks Minnesota is also beginning to fill up the stages. The room, however, has not. We have not opened registration on that yet, although we will very soon. In fact, it's probably happening as you listen to this. So go to minnesota.devicetalks.com to check out that program. We're very, 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 very happy to be back in the Twin Cities and looking forward to bringing you a great program and rolling out those speakers as well. So without any further delay, I'd like to start my conversation with Daniel Hawkins, the CEO of Vista AI. All right, you ready for this?
Ready.
Well, Daniel Hawkins, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. Good to see you.
It's great to see you again. You've been a fixture at our Device Talks events and on our podcast, and you were kind enough to have me by your former company's headquarters to check out things, which was a real treat. So really, really do appreciate the support and the friendship with Device Talks, and it's great to have you back on the podcast. That's a mouthful, but just wanted to get that all out there. We're going to talk about the company you're now leading, your new role as CEO of Vista AI. But I want to just unpack your medtech career very quickly, because you've been on the podcast before, but it's definitely worth repeating. I mean, just looking at your LinkedIn profile, past companies Intuitive, you were a co-inventor of the technology that was part of Calibra Medical, that's now part of C-Cure. You were a co-founder of Shockwave. I mean, these are all companies that I think people have heard of, Daniel. Like, you've got a pretty good track record there. They've all been in the news like over the last year, it seems, between big rounds and new robotic systems and acquisitions. So you clearly came into medtech for the right reasons, but what brought you into medtech initially?
So frankly, growing up in a physician's household, an entrepreneurial household is really what peaked, or I'll say was the foundation of my interest. My dad's a doc, hung a shingle right out of med school. And in doing that, had his own business. So we were a healthcare household from the very beginning, and it was all really centered around taking care of patients and what's right. to take care of patients. And that drove me. I was always interested in science, but I also knew that I did not have what my dad had in terms of the disposition and the right drive to myself be a physician. I thought about it briefly. I went to business undergrad and even tried to advocate to the dean of the Wharton School where I went and the dean of the college to try to do a joint pre-med and Wharton undergrad program. And
wow.
Thankfully, they didn't let me do that because that would have been academic suicide. But that was really my drive and my passion. And I had had entrepreneurial experiences since I was 11 years old. And that led me to want to be involved in the business of healthcare, which turned out for almost my entire career to be medical devices.
I want to rapid fire go through your positions in a moment, but that's a great point about dispositions. I would think, and maybe this isn't fair, but physicians, I think their pursuit is maintenance and doing well, but maintenance and keeping people healthy and sort of not necessarily bringing change. Some may, of course, but entrepreneurs want to bring, I think, change. Do you see a difference in the personality types between an effective physician and an effective entrepreneur? And again, conceding that there's some people who share those qualities, but
yeah, some do. There's some notables in history, but I am very, very interested and driven by disruption. You use that word; it's one of my favorite words because we can't, as a society, to call it holistically or as an industry, advance without disruption. I hadn't really thought about the difference in personalities in that fashion. I would say my disposition was about trying to have as much of an impact to as many people as humanly possible. And the way I described it to my father when I was chatting with him about it is, hey, Dad, you treated patients for 50 years one-on-one. Mm-hmm. I want to treat patients for 50 years one to millions. Mm-hmm. And that drive is discordant with one-on-one care. That's what I meant by disposition. For me, it was I wanted to try to create technologies and enable technologies so that physicians have more capability to treat more patients and move on to the next one. And that's really what I've done throughout my career.
That's great. Very quickly, I want to hit upon the company as I referenced earlier. So Intuitive, you joined in January 1996. If I remember correctly, I think were you employee? You were in the single digits, right? Was it?
Number six.
I was going to say six. Do you remember, it's easy to say now, I knew it would be big. Did you know it would be big? Did you know it was game changing? Or were you just sort of, it was a cool company and maybe it was Facebook, maybe it was MySpace. I don't know what it's going to be. Or did you have a strong sense that this was going to be a big thing someday?
So I knew what the core premise of what Intuitive was seeking to do was massively disruptive. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to say I had, at that point in my career, the combination of misplaced bravado.
You placed it pretty well, I think. I think you placed it just right. Fun.
misplaced bravado as a recently minted MBA with minimal career experience, probably 3 years at that time or something. And a foundational belief that what they were doing at Intuitive, what Fred had set out to do, was extremely disruptive, that if it worked, we would change surgery. And did I know it was going to? No, I'm not going to say that. That would be an ignorant statement. But I would say that there was a core belief that it is up to us to make it work. Mm-hmm. And that's the essence of entrepreneurship to me, is that kind of a belief and the empowerment that provides. And there were many, many, many high pucker moments of we're betting the company on what's next. But that kind of a mission of large incision to small and all the benefits that creates and greater precision and new surgical opportunities, that was a hard driving fact that I think everybody at the organization felt empowered by. I'd say the most humbling moment is when I got asked to write the market section of the S-1 statement for the public offering. Mm. And I needed to look at 38 procedure categories. And then I started to realize, wait a minute, if we can have that kind of an impact across all of those, this is not only big, it's going to be gigantic, but mm-hmm. it's a big if.
Absolutely. So
I believed, but I wouldn't say I knew. That's a leap.
People would find it hard to believe that there were a lot of question marks back then as to whether or not it was just a marketing stunt or a really effective medicine.
So yeah, the company almost died a few times.
Yeah, for sure. So your next two ventures, they're completely different, but you're listed as co-inventor of the Simplicity insulin delivery device, which is now, as I mentioned, part of C-Cure after being acquired by J&J, and Shockwave Medical. Shockwave Medical story, if anyone can Google it, I think there are some great videos on it. It's just a classic three entrepreneurs in a garage trying to create a solution to a problem. Well, talk a bit about, and I don't know if those stories are the same. I don't know the C-Cure or the Simplicity story, but talk about the process of inventing, because unlike Intuitive, where you joined a company that had a concept and you were buying in at the ground floor, you were really, at least with Shockwave, you were really, you identified a problem and you just kept at it until you came up with a solution that's now a $13 billion acquisition by J&J.
Yeah, it was $13 billion. That's right. So they both the Simplicity and the Intuitive device followed essentially the exact same process. Late in my career, late relative to the Intuitive portion, I was asked by a couple of venture capital firms to join some entrepreneurs in Seattle to start companies for the venture firm. So that model was an interesting one. They gave us a couple of million dollars and said, go figure out an unmet clinical need and either in-license the technology to meet that need or invent it. Mm-hmm. And that's the only direction. So any sounds condition, awesome. Any patient population is entirely up to us. So exactly. For me, that was kid in a candy store stuff. That's mm-hmm. absolutely great. And our first identified issue was mealtime, or what's called prandial insulin delivery, and the personal elements of doing that, and the need for discretion and expediency and not having to carry around your kit if you have diabetes, carry around your kit of syringes and the weird looks you get in the bathroom if you're trying to tap insulin into a syringe. People think you're shooting heroin. Mm-hmm. All of those dynamics caused us to realize that there's an opportunity for a skin-worn, fully mechanical mealtime insulin delivery patch pump. So we invented it. Mm-hmm. And it was, frankly, as plain as that. We identified the opportunity and invented for it. And, you know, that was John Adams, Cliff Alfredness, and I. And I'll say I co-invented. I'm being gentle on myself. Those guys invented it, and I invented a little bit of extra something now and again. Right. But they taught me how to invent. That becomes important because of John Adams and I re-upped after we had started the company. The three of us started the company that became the developer of the Simplicity. John Adams and I re-upped and decided to do it again. And I started inventing myself because they taught me how to do it. Mm-hmm. And in doing so, I came up with the idea to put lithotripsy in an angioplasty balloon, and we did it. Now, the venture folks were a little skeptical. Ultimately, it was 2008, 2009. Nothing was getting funded, and we needed to shut down the incubator. And intellectual property, when you shut down an entity, becomes public knowledge and publicly accessible. I wasn't interested in that, so I used kids' college fund money to buy the IP. Wow. Prior to doing that, right? And you know, you ask me a question relative to Intuitive. I'm going to ask and answer that question. Did I believe for Shockwave that it would work? I didn't just believe; I literally knew, mm-hmm. and I knew because I had studied hard enough with physiology. I had studied enough with John, enough about lithotripsy. We had tried some cadaveric experimentation, and we just knew it was going to work. So with that, I wasn't going to release it. There was absolutely no way. And multiple years later, after doing nights and weekends for a number of years, I was able to raise a Series A and took over full time in 2012 and ran it for 5.5 years.
Wow. So I love that you said you learned how to invent. Is inventing something, a piece of knowledge that can be transferred to anyone? Is it an innate skill that you can bring out of somebody? Is there just a simple formula to inventing that, you know, anyone can, well, at least find some level of success with. They may not get a $13 billion payout ultimately.
Yeah, but. I mean, certainly that's an anomaly, and there's no way I'm going to sit here and say that that was predictable. It simply wasn't. I knew the clinical outcomes would be about what they were. Mm-hmm. Because early on, we saw evidence that suggested that's how it was going to go. But I had absolutely no clue that it was going to have that kind of success to tumbling. But to your question, I think inventing can be taught to anybody who's very observant and very curious. That combination, well, you have to have a lot of drive too, but I'll say those three things I could teach the foundational skills of invention to anybody who has those three things.
Let's talk about the company that I met you at. I met you when you were CEO of Avail Med Systems. I think we first talked in 2020 when the pandemic was starting to settle. And we began to hear from companies like Avail. And Avail was founded a few years before that were developing ways to improve communications in the OR. Talk a bit about the Avail product for a moment, and ultimately it didn't work out. Financing got the financing environment became, I think, harder for everybody, and it's one of those, I think, sadder stories. I'd like to ask you about that, but just reintroduce our audience to the Avail concept.
So the basic concept there, it was a pre-pandemic concept, as you noted.
Yeah.
It was to solve a structural problem in medical device education and distribution, and that is that large cap companies field quite literally thousands, tens of thousands of people into quote unquote the field, if you will, to interact with customers, to educate on new products, to support physicians while they treat patients using those products. And it's a very significant portion of the overall expense structure. That, by the thesis, if you will, that we had in starting the company, was really driving a set of decision-making processes for commercialization, provided limitations for early stage companies to be able to bring technologies to market themselves. It became the catalyst, or I'll say has become the catalyst, for a lot of the integral structure in the medical device business and go-to-market strategies. Mm-hmm. To put a fine point on it, short side, it's about 17-18% of every dollar in sales is spent in the commercial infrastructure that is out there. Long side, it can be as much as 45%, depending on the segment and the company and what have you. That's a whole lot of money spent, providing the support, when in reality, despite all of that, there's no way that industry has an ability to be everywhere they're needed when they're needed. That sounds like a whole lot of money. It's quite literally billions and billions and billions of dollars. We provided a technology that we never had any intent to impact the number of people out in the field. I think early on we were asked whether or not what we're trying to do is replace reps. That is not in the slightest what we were trying to do. What we're trying to do is let the field force leverage their capability exactly when their customer needed it, but do so remotely by putting hardware in rooms that had screens and hookups for intraprocedural imaging and cameras, so that somebody outside of the operating room could be at an instant inside of the operating room and provide the procedural support and education necessary. That was the premise. Then the pandemic happened, and it, from a demand perspective, obviously blew up.
Mm-hmm. So you were able to raise, Avail Med Systems was able to raise $100 million. A large part of that, I think, came 2020, 2021. So during that environment when everything seemed to be up in the air. And that was the building that you were kind enough to offer me a tour of. And I was, as we talked before I pushed record, very impressed with the technology. It was super sleek. You could see it working. It made perfect sense. Then unfortunately, a short time later, you ran up against the challenges that a lot of startups do, which is finding financing to continue the story. Can you speak a bit as to what happened, why you were not successful in raising that second round? Or the additional round? So, I think it was the second round.
That would have been a Series C, so that was the third. But one of the downsides of disruption, by definition, you're taking today's status quo and making it tomorrow's reality, or changing it, I'll say, to tomorrow's reality. That process takes variable lengths of time. It takes, in some instances, like what we were doing at Intuitive, an extraordinary amount of capital. For Avail, it also took an extraordinary amount, in aggregate, $147 million. A lot of dough. We had begun to get very, very nice traction in the 12 months preceding when we needed to ultimately, we lost financing and had to sell assets. When you're creating that kind of disruption, the length of time that change takes has the opportunity to cause a bit of an imbalance with the overall financing needs of a company. Mm-hmm. And if that time period extends far enough that you have to create enough infrastructure that your cash requirements get extremely high, but you have yet to have made enough progress to move that transition, there's an imbalance. And we had some of that imbalance. We were by far the leaders in the market from a revenue perspective and a reputation perspective and everything. The aggregate market was running through that maturity cycle I just described. Layer on top of that, an extraordinarily difficult financing environment. The preceding years were the nearly free money post-pandemic years. And I think as an industry, we're still dealing with the hangover, if you will, that came from too much capital. Mm-hmm. Valuations are still too high. And capital is being deployed more conservatively than it was, I'll call it 7 years ago, 6 years ago. That combination at the moment we were trying to raise financing is what made it impossible to raise the capital necessary and forced our hand. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to be clear, our existing investors were extraordinarily supportive. But there's limits, and those limits were met, and unfortunately, the result that we have is that we needed to cease operation and sell assets.
We'll talk about Vista AI in a moment, but I just want to last question about this. As I mentioned, you were at many of our Device Talks meetings, and I got to know a lot of your teammates there, I know it was. It had a seismic impact on the industry. I think people were surprised to hear the news. What is the process like for you? I mean, you kind of create this entity, you develop this idea, you create this company, you build this entity, this organization, you hire the people for it. I mean, you're all pulling on this. You're all like you were at Intuitive or your previous companies where you're all believing in this mission, and to have that mission suddenly stop. What is that feeling like? And I imagine it's going to be a sad and painful experience.
It's excruciating.
Yeah.
It's absolutely excruciating. And my team, when I announced it to them, Tom, it takes a lot for me to get choked up on stuff. I got choked up. It was hard.
Yeah.
Really, really hard. And you know, I felt so badly for all of the efforts that my team put forward to create that industry the way they did. And, you know, I ended up spending a number of months following that, doing what I can to open doors and help people get landed while we were dealing with the aftermath of that whole process in terms of the selling of the assets and whatnot. At a personal level for me, it's very, very difficult. My current company, Vista, is my ninth startup. So at that point, that was my eighth. And that became the second one that didn't have an exit. Mm-hmm. And that became particularly difficult because I was 7 years doing that one. And the way I kind of look at it is that we were leading a pack of about four or five folks in a marathon. We were on mile number five. Everybody else is back on mile number two. We're on mile number five, and then we got hit by a bus. Mm-hmm. You know, so, I mean, we're just taken out of the game.
I'm a fan of verbal images, and that's a good one.
We got hit by a bus.
Yeah.
So you know, imagine in the bushes, bloodied and full of all the adrenaline of the race, I couldn't stop there.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, after a bit of time helping team and taking, you know, I'll say a couple of months of a breather, I started listening to the inbounds. There were a number of inbounds and, you know, six or eight or whatever over the course of 2 months. And, you know, there was a point at which I weeded through a few and ultimately ended up digging in on a couple. And one of those was Vista. And I saw some things that made me feel like we had an opportunity to change medicine. And that's really why I got into this.
Great.
Is to have a chance to change medicine. First with Intuitive, second with Shockwave, and I want a hat trick. I want to have that third one.
Well, let's unpack that. And admittedly, when I heard you join this company, I was surprised because I didn't know anything about the company, but it just seemed as if you were a medical device person. You created things that were made of plastic and that people either attached to their bodies or put in their bodies or surgeons put in their bodies and took, but they were physical things. This seemed more software. This almost, I don't know if it was an imaging company, but as you and I talked prior to the recording, you know, I'm getting a clearer picture. So help our audience understand, you know, what is Vista? Is it Vista AI or is it Vista? I keep saying Vista AI, but I see
it's Vista AI, okay. That's the name of the company.
Okay.
I guess what you're essentially asking is why did I pick this instead of a traditional medical device?
Yeah. Well, I was going to go there, but yeah. Why did you pick what, I guess the more gentle way of asking the question, like, what did you find so appealing about Vista AI?
Sure. So my entire career has been spent in the patients in a room on a table, direct interaction with whatever device it is or equipment it is and that patient. There's an upstream process that's missing. That upstream process is the right patient to the table. That's the diagnostics. And I had never been much for diagnostics, just by disposition. I was more interested in the procedure room.
Mm-hmm.
But what convinced me when I heard the story about Vista is an understanding that one of the founders, Bob Hu, is a cardiologist out of Stanford, one of the primary creators of the technology, shared with me that as a cardiologist, he became somewhat dismayed by the available imaging modalities to be able to properly assess a patient before cardiovascular care, be it catheter-based or surgical. And went on to describe that cardiac MR is actually proven by literature, peer-reviewed, the number one gold standard across virtually every diagnostic test you'd want to do, non-invasive imaging test you'd want to do on a patient, the gold standard from a clinical perspective.
Mm-hmm.
It is. If you run a list, there's actually a paper published in 2016 on this topic. If you run a list of all the disease states that you'd otherwise want to investigate on the left side, and you have a chart that goes sort of left to right with echo and CMR and nuclear imaging and CT, and green means good. It's a waterfall of green for CMR.
Mm-hmm.
And no other modality comes close. However, today there's only 400,000 CMRs done. There's 3.5 million nuclear imaging studies done. And there's 16 million 2D echoes done. All for that same list of indications. And what Bob went on to describe to me is if CMR were universally available and quality could be assured and the time it took could be predictable, there's zero clinical reason why it shouldn't be 6, 7, 8 million scans done a year.
Mm-hmm.
It'll never take over from Echo, because Echo is simple. It's in doc's offices. There's lots of reasons why. There's economic reasons why. There's workflow reasons why. But there are quite literally millions and millions of patients that are being diagnosed on modalities that don't give the appropriate amount of data to make the most informed decision that as a community, the clinicians would otherwise prefer and rely on. So that got me interested, really interested. And when I poked at it, what I came to understand is MRI machines are essentially very, very complicated cameras. Mm-hmm. And I never understood as a patient or a family member of a patient, you know, somebody in my family needing to get an MR, why the docs would consistently say, please choose from any of these four imaging centers or two imaging centers, pick one or whatever it is. I never really understood. I assumed it was just some referral pattern thing and some economics or whatever. Some of that's probably there. What I've since come to understand is, yes, the camera matters to what you ultimately get, meaning the MRI machine. The photographer or the role of the technologist is essentially the photographer in this example. That's where the rubber meets the road. Mm-hmm. These are hard jobs. Hmm. So the interface that these folks need to work with is very complicated. And the single most complicated exam you can actually do as a technologist on an MRI machine is cardiac. You've got to make 300 clicks, 300 times to be able to get an exam done, probably somewhere near half to two-thirds of which involve judgment. That's extraordinary, right? So in that world, it's very, very, very difficult to do those exams, and you can imagine the variability of that. And as it further turns out, that limits access. And I couldn't sit still when I heard that. I needed to do something.
What is left open to judgment? What is the judgment used for? Is it the angle? Is it the viewpoint?
In photography terms, think exposure. Depth of field. Mm-hmm. Think contrast ratio. And the problem is that the human heart's beating, the patient's breathing, and you've got to take three-dimensional slices to get certain edges of anatomy, certain anatomy at different angles, mm-hmm. to be able to provide the diagnostic data that's important. Every human heart that is in normal anatomic position is slightly left-sided to sternum, pointed with the apex slightly posterior, but everybody's different. And because of that, in three-dimensional space, each of the valves is presented in a different place. Hmm. The angle that you need to take the picture to get what's called a four-chamber view of the heart, cross-sectionally from the top of the heart down to the bottom of the heart, is slightly different. Those are all judgment decisions. Those all require that you know the anatomy, that you know what the scanner's capable of, that the ratio, contrast ratios need to be right, that what's called black blood is done properly, that the venc or fine-tuning of the contrast is there. And it's a lot to be thinking about. Hmm. And the folks who do this are extraordinarily skilled at what they do. The problem is I went to a conference for technologists broadly for MRI. And one of the speakers asked everybody, there's about 300 people in the room, everybody who's trained on cardiac MR, please raise your hand. Two people raised their hand.
Wow.
Two people. That's extraordinary. Our software uses artificial intelligence and specifically neural networks to mimic human behavior. Mm-hmm. Our software does machine reads on images to understand the exact anatomical position of a particular patient's heart, knows what is successfully described as a four-chamber view, to my earlier example, and will mimic the human decision-making on all of those clicks to get the machine to get the ideal four-chamber view. In the right contrast and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? It'll make all of those decisions. So what we're able to do is in the extreme, fully automate the acquisition or scanning process, image acquisition or scanning process for cardiac MR. What that then means is somebody who's never done one can do one that is clinically competent and relevant for diagnosis at one of the leading teaching institutions in the country, and produce an image that is as if they've been doing it for 5, 7, 10 years.
So does your technology, does it qualify as AI? I mean, AI is in your name. The website says AI-powered imaging software. Are you using artificial intelligence?
We are. We are, but it's a subset. This is not generative AI. We're not using data lakes to be able to match images and all that. That's not how it's done. These are neural networks.
Okay. So please explain to me how your system becomes part of an MRI machine, and what is the process like for the technologist using a machine that has Vista's assistance?
Sure. So we are actually installed on a workstation that is operationally just a little bit upstream to the either GE or Siemens workstations. Mm-hmm. We've got read-write capability right now in cardiac MR where we can actually control GE and Siemens machines using our software. And we do that through the scanner's own sort of operating system and workstation, if you will, but we're installed on a separate one. And we install our software not on the machine itself, but on a workstation, and essentially daisy chain hardwire that through to be able to directly control the MR machine completely on premises. And it's done, in microseconds in mm-hmm. terms of time interval. We don't go out to the cloud or any of that stuff. It's all very local. So we're able to real time read, write, control, and our software is able to essentially mimic the human decisions as I described in real time while the exam is going on. What does that ultimately mean? The technologist, and to be clear, I don't think I said this previously, there's about 41,000 technologists that are in the country right now. Mm-hmm. There's a roughly 15% shortage relative to need for those technologists. These jobs are so demanding to do more and more and more exams, not just cardiac, but other anatomies. And Vista's going into every anatomy that's out there. Our next ones are going to be brain and prostate that mm-hmm. will launch over the next quarter and a half or so. Their technologists are getting asked, because of an increasing demand in MRIs, to do more and more and more with the same. That's leading to fairly high pressure environments when you mm-hmm. chat with them. And there's a fair bit of job satisfaction mismatch, and folks are leaving the business or switching jobs. It turns out there's an 18% turnover. So almost 1 in 5 technologists every year will leave to go to another role.
Wow.
Which is pretty extraordinary. So when you're thinking about a hospital imaging department, or you're one of the chains like a RadNet or a SimonMed, that's a lot to manage, mm-hmm. right? So our software allows technologists who are very good at what they do to do more with same. It takes the pressure off of, we have to squeeze in an extra 2 exams. How does it do that? Because we can more consistently, using our software, generate the scanning images that are necessary in shorter time periods with less variability in that time. And that allows more patients to be predictably put on the schedule, and it alleviates that pressure, right, for the technologist. There's something else it does that's really interesting, is that by automating that decision-making, we are putting the output, if you will, the quality of the scan in a tighter band, meaning that the quality is more consistent. And statistically, we've shown in a study at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, a little bit better statistically. I don't know that it's clinically meaningful. What's most important is that it's not worse, mm-hmm. but it's in a very, very tight band across experience levels of technologists. That matters because the radiologist downstream now knows what he or she should be expecting. It's an easier read that's faster. So that's also a downstream process that is being helped by all of this. Operationally, for a technologist, they put the patient into the scanner and do the normal prep they would otherwise do. Then they start the scanning process on the GE or Siemens workstation. Minute later, they move over to the workstation hosting Vista. And as soon as they start the Vista software, that locks out the scanner's workstation, and then the full user interface is on Vista.
Okay.
They then operate completely on Vista and could choose to go full automatic, which means they just click a button and they wait. Then the scan gets completed. They can then look at the scan and assess, and if there's something that needs a tweak here or there, they could go repeat a portion if they choose to, or they're done.
Mm-hmm.
Versus they got to stare at the screen and make all the decisions in real time from one portion of the requirement for the scan to the next, to the next, to the next. And that intense concentration is candidly hard to do for mm-hmm. an extended time period, 8, 10, 12, 15 times a day. So we alleviate some of that pressure and an operational strain, workflow strain on the technologist.
So you started this off by explaining how few of these procedures are done compared to the other technologies used to achieve a diagnostic. So what problems is Vista AI solving to increase that number? What was holding that number back?
So the main thing that's holding that back, and we actually did a survey at the TCT course, Transcatheter Therapeutics course, this past fall, where a room full of cardiologists was asked, what are the barriers for cardiac MRI to be considered a first line of choice for evaluation of patients? The number one answer for 82% response was technology access and training.
Hmm.
As it turns out, 2% of all MRI machines in the U.S. are regularly used for cardiac imaging.
Wow.
2%. So because of where you live and where I live, there are places close by that do it. But most of the country, in fact, it turns out over 80% of the U.S. population doesn't live near a place that does cardiac MRI. And that's because it's so difficult to do.
Hmm.
But our software eliminates that problem. So we end up with a very, very different opportunity for access. And by changing the access, the clinical arguments are very clear. The reimbursement is already there for it. So the economic arguments are tucked away. By enabling cardiac MR to be done in any location that is compatible, which is GE and Siemens machines going back respectively 12 and 8 years, machines and software, we're changing the number of access points. By changing the number of access points, my diligence into this with cardiology friends that I know from my Shockwave days, it's very, very clear. The modality will get used. So with that, we have an opportunity to grow that, to grow that business substantially by orders of magnitude. And in doing so, enable cardiologists to get access to the imaging they need to most appropriately, based on clinical evidence, most appropriately identify the appropriate therapy. I'm gonna give you a quick stat that to me was one of the most troubling and drove me to want to do this more than anything else. There's a study done on mitral regurgitation, so leaky mitral valves, where they were studied, as is typical practice, using echocardiography. So just the echo, typical echo that's in a cardiologist's office. It turns out that about 15% of all echoes are non-diagnostic for patient anatomy reasons, or because the sonographer missed the calling, if you will. They didn't mm-hmm. quite get the exam done. But in this particular study, they're trying to assess the leakiness of mitral valves. There was a sub-study of those where a group of patients were subsequently followed up using cardiac MRI. Then all the patients who were diagnosed with enough leakiness to warrant intervention by echocardiography went to surgery. Of those patients that were subsequently studied with cardiac MRI, only 30%, 3 out of 10, were confirmed on cardiac MRI to have actually had surgery-worthy conditions, if you will. post-surgery, only 3 out of 10 actually showed benefit from the surgery. Those three that were confirmed using cardiac MRI. Why is that? So in other words, 7 out of 10 patients went to surgery for mitral repair or replacement, but did not need it clinically based on the assessment done by cardiac MRI. Why is that true? It is true because the trigger for having an intervention for mitral regurgitation, also true for tricuspid, also true for aortic, is a certain amount of volume of blood that is leaky. Echocardiography is a difficult modality to assess that because you're trying to assess something at the exact right angle to be able to do the exam, and that's hard to do. But even if it's perfectly done, it doesn't quantify it. And if you were to take a perfectly done exam and put it in front of 5 cardiologists, you're going to get 3 answers as to what the estimated volume is. That's important because the absolute volume is the trigger for surgery or no surgery. Cardiac MRI quantifies the volume precisely. And that's the reason why there were patients who were confirmed using cardiac MR, and those were the ones that showed clinical benefit. That tells me that patients ended up on the table when they shouldn't have been there. And, if you go back to the top of the why did I want to get into imaging? Because I want to make sure that the patients who are supposed to be on the table are on the table. And can we use neural networks in Vista AI's case? Can we use neural networks to make sure that happens more often? And the answer is yes, we can. And that's what we're doing.
Last area to discuss, you referenced or mentioned the shortage of technologists, the 18% who leave every year. How do you see this helping that? Is it making their job easier, therefore less stressful, therefore they stay? Or do you, and I don't want to put anything out there, but or is this a case where you'll be someday, some technologists will be able to do multiple scans because they've got these tools and they're able to handle more workload, or you just need fewer technologists because you have products like this?
So all of the above, except the last one. I don't believe we're ever going to need fewer technologists. I really don't. Fundamentally, I take exception to that. The job will become easier, as evidenced by our work at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. There was initially some resistance to the notion of AI, ultimately adoption, and now conviction. We don't want this to go away because our jobs are so much more why we got into this career choice in the first place. We're able to take care of patients because the monotonous routine things are taken care of using software. So job satisfaction matters a lot. And if you were to speak to administration in hospitals, you will hear that they're trying to make sure that they're able to keep staffing at the levels that are necessary, and this is a tool to be able to do that. Multiple exams done by one technologist is currently being done now, but it's being done remotely. Where, in the example of cardiac, you've got to pay attention to multiple exams and do all the clicks on multiple exams simultaneously. So you got to have a special kind of brain to be able to do that. That's pretty tough.
Yeah.
Our software puts the technologist in a position of observing the scan rather than doing the scan. Right. So that's a very different role that speaks to both sides of what you just described. First one being job satisfaction, because that observation is less strenuous than doing. But to the point of multiple exams, we do have some customers that have great interest in and have asked us for assistance in enabling 2-up, 4-up, even 6-up. I think 6 probably too many, but certainly 2 or 4-up screens with multiple exams happening at the same time, because our software allows for the technologist to exception manage through observation. And I referenced it briefly, but I want to lean back to it. We spent a lot of time talking about cardiac. We're extending this technology to every other anatomy. The next one we will release is brain and prostate at the same time. followed by spine, upper and lower extremities, and we're going to continue because in varying degrees, every single exam type has similar issues. And we see an opportunity to impact how MR is used, alleviate the staffing strains that we've spent a few moments talking about, and enable facilities to avoid what is currently significant backlogs in being able to get scans done. In cardiac, that's between 4 and 12 weeks often, which is that's nuts. That's just nuts. In other modalities or other anatomies, it tends to be generally less, but variable across by facility. And our software can help alleviate all of that.
Great. And final question, just about the company itself. You mentioned the products that may roll out. What is the status of your cardiac MR product that you're out there? I don't know what sort of regulatory approval is needed. I'm sure there's something. I'm sure there's a lot.
There is.
So where are you with sort of the product development and regulatory, and that'll kind of inform my last question, which is about fundraising. We talked about fundraising early on. Where are you with that process?
So we are commercial in cardiac right now. Brigham and Women's in Boston is probably our most significant user. They do nearly 2,000 scans a year using our software. And we are on the cusp of installing another handful, I'll say, and anticipate by the end of this coming year, it's going to be dozens. With respect to fundraising, we historically, before I came in, the company was financed largely by Koshla Ventures, out of the Bay Area here. And that was through a Series A and convertible notes and what have you. Subsequently, when I joined, we started a Series B process, and I'm in the midst of that Series B now, and anticipate a raise somewhere in the $20 million range for the Series B. Koshla has made a very meaningful commitment to that supportively, and there's lots of interest from health systems and financial investors in what we're doing. So I'm in the midst of that. So wish me luck in this environment. It's a tough environment.
Absolutely. We'll wish you the best of luck, and I enjoy helping you tell your stories on the podcast, and glad you have a new one to share with us. So Daniel, thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks very much. Great to see you.
Okay, well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. Once again, join us at Device Talks Boston and Device Talks Minnesota. Go to those websites to register. Registration for Device Talks Minnesota probably is open. I mean, this is probably an hour-long podcast, so by the time you were done listening to it, from the time I started, it probably opened. So we've got some great speakers coming up. I'll be putting them out on LinkedIn to keep track of those. Connect with me on LinkedIn, of course. Would love to be part of your MedTech conversations. Connect with Kayleen Brown, our fantastic managing editor, and connect with the amazing Chris Newmarker, executive editor at Mass Device. Don't forget to subscribe to the Device Talks Podcast Network. We have some great new podcasts coming out your way. That way you don't miss a future episode. And of course, as I said, check out our building roster of Device Talks Tuesdays discussions. So we've got a ton of stuff going on here at Device Talks, and look forward to bringing you many, many, many MedTech insights in the future. Thanks for joining us.